And what does your name say about you? Oh, I got to tell you this real quick. This is going to make me look bad. We did a singing every year at Asheville. And it's like you do here at Jacksonville. And we'd have people put their names in a box. If you want to lead a song, write your name down on a piece of paper. And we'll draw your name and you'll come up and sing and we'll announce it just like we do here. Well, I saw some teenagers milling around the box when I came in. And I thought, teenagers, you never know what they're up to. And so when it was time to read off the names, I thought, oh, you thought you was going to be sneaky, didn't you? Thought you was going to put one over Renfro and you don't know who you're up against. All right, who wrote down Ricky Bobby? Ricky Bobby, Talladega Nights, Will Ferrell. I thought, all right, Ricky Bobby. And then I saw somebody going. Brother Ricky Bobby, come up and lead a song. Because some of you know Brother Ricky Bobby. What do you do? I don't know what to do with that, but laugh and just go on. You think you just learn to shut up, but you don't. You just... Brother, what are the odds of that? Brother Ricky Bobby. I just knew the teenagers had done that. They had not. Before Brianna was born, you see the book here. I remember looking through a big book of baby names with Amanda, because not just anything will pair up with Renfro. You got a Smith, her maiden name, Smith, anything goes with Smith, but Renfro, we saw the name, not that we were going to pick it, but we saw the name Rory, R-O-R-Y. Try that one out. Rory Renfro. Sounds like Scooby-Doo talking, doesn't it? Rory Renfro. So you got to be careful. Today, parents will often go for trendy names. According to the Social Security Administration, the three most popular girl names in the United States are Emma, Olivia, and Sophia. But in Bible times, I think they were more often likely to choose a name for its meaning or for the situation out of which the name was given. The name Isaac, for example, means he laughs. Remember when Abraham was told he was going to have a son and he laughed? Well, according to one source, there are 3,237 different people mentioned in the Bible. 3,237. A little over half of those had unique names. In other words, they don't share a name with somebody else. But that means that the other half of people mentioned in the Bible share a name with another character. According to the Biographical Bible, there are 5 different Johns, 13 different Josephs, I didn't know that, and 31 different Zacharias in the Bible. I'm almost going to have to see that to believe it. 31 different Zacharias. In many cases, children were given names that had family connections. Lee, the name Lee runs in Amanda's family. Her grandmother was Liddell Johnson. Amanda's mother is Myra Lee. Amanda is Amanda Lee. So when we had our oldest, Brianna, our first, we named her Brianna Lee. 4 generations of Lees. And then apparently it didn't register with us that we named Brianna, Brianna Lee. Then we had Leah. We never put that together. And then our third child, surprise, we just didn't name her Lee. But then her name is Hadley, so it's like we just can't help ourselves. And that was not intentional. But do you remember when John the Baptist was born and his parents said his name is John? What did his friends say? None of your relatives. They're none of your relatives that have that name. Turn in your Bibles to 1 Samuel. Today we're going to notice a couple of names in the Bible. See what we can learn from them. 3,237 different names. I thought I'd tell you we're going to survey each one of them very briefly. Book of 1 Samuel, chapter 1, opens with the story of a man named Elkanah. He had 2 wives. One was Hannah, the other was Peninnah. Peninnah had children, Hannah did not. Hannah was barren. And Peninnah did what to us would be the unthinkable. She provoked her rival. She made fun of Hannah, poked at her, belittled her because Hannah was not able to have children. And of course, that made Hannah very sad, despondent. On one occasion, she was particularly distressed, and Hannah went into the temple to pray. Remember, she prayed, her lips were moving, and Eli saw her, thought that she was drunk. She said, "I'm not drunk." She said, she was pouring out her spirit to the Lord. But she said this in her prayer. She said, "God, if you will look on my affliction, and if you will give me a son, I will give him to you all the days of his life." Look at 1 Samuel 1, drop down to verse 20. We're told that in due time, Hannah conceived and she bore a son. And she called his name Samuel, for she said, "I have asked for him from the Lord." She named him Samuel. Look at it. Samuel. L, that E-L ending is the shortened version of the Hebrew word for God, Elohim. Like you'll see El Shaddai in the old, God Almighty, the various names of God that are used with that stem, E-L. So Samuel means asked of God. This was the boy that she had asked for from God. They wouldn't tell us this story when I was a kid in Bible class at Piedmont, about a woman that said, "If you'll give me a son, I'll give him back to you." They wouldn't tell. They thought it would scare us that our parents were going to take us to church and leave us there. That's what I was told. They didn't tell y'all that when you were little. Well, do we think of our children like she thought of Samuel, as gifts from God with physical and emotional, spiritual responsibilities? One of my favorite passages along those lines, Psalm 127. It's really, you know, verses 3 through 5 or so. But look at verse 4. "Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth." Let me ask you this. You ever thought about this? Those of you that have younger children, children still at home, what are you doing? Where are you aiming your arrows? Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, where are you? In other words, what are your goals for your children? What are your plans for them? I know we think about, well, I want them to go to college, and I really want them to get a job someday, and that's fine, that's true. But that's not what we ought to be primarily concerned with. I know it seems some parents are primarily concerned about how popular their child is, how well they're accepted or fit in. Are they in the right clique? Are they in the right club, the right group? Do they know the right people? I wonder, you know, and I'm talking to myself, and this may be more of interest to people that have, you know, younger kids. We do. I think about it. I mean, it's what's on my mind. But do we realize the awesome responsibility? I don't mean awesome as in cool. I mean as in tremendous responsibility that God has given parents with their children. Do you ever pray, and I think about this, and I'm not the only person who does this, but I will pray at night, you know, or I'll pray, and if I have time, I can really think about things, and I pray, "Lord, I want, may our children obey the gospel. I want Brianna and Leah Hadley Jackson, I want our children to obey the gospel, but more than that, I want them to be faithful to you. I want them to grow up and love you. I want them to be faithful to you. You know, yes, I obviously want them to obey the gospel, put on Christ in baptism, but I don't want them to stop there. Well, I've been baptized, I'm going to heaven." I don't want them to feel that way. I want them to love. But how am I going to do that? Just sit here and hope they do? Sure do hope they love the Lord and they grow up. I mean, you have to plan. Hannah had plans for Samuel. You ever think about who they'll marry? Ever think about that? Or maybe try not to think about it. You know, but then pray to God about that. I know somewhere out there, there's some kids right now that my kids one day are going to marry. And I know that as much as we want to do our very best to raise them, I know a lot of their spirituality is going to depend in large measure, part of it at least, on who they marry. Are they going to marry someone who helps them get to heaven? Or someone who hinders them? Because that's the only two choices really, help or hinder. I think about things like that. Well, here's what's interesting. And I like Hannah's attitude. "If you'll give me a son, I'm giving him to you." And that's how we ought to feel. as far as dedicating them, their lives to Christ. I heard Wendell Winkler say once, I think I'd gone a couple of weeks without mentioning him, so I'm starting a new streak this morning. But this is what Brother Winkler said. He said, if you were to ask a Jewish person, well, what will your child be when he grows up? He said, 99 out of 100 Orthodox Jews remain Orthodox Jews. He said, if you were to ask a Catholic, what will your child be when he grows up? 9 out of 10 will be Catholic all their life. He said, but you ask a member of the Church of Christ, what will your child be when they grow up? And he'll say, oh, if I only knew. He said, what's the difference? What's the difference? And he ultimately concluded, education. He said, why can't we say they'll be a Christian for all their life? He said, it all boils down to training. He said, study the education of Jewish children. Study the education of Catholic children, how they take them to catechism without an absence. Why can't we have that training? Ephesians 6:4, fathers, don't provoke them to wrath or to anger, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. I remember a preacher when I was growing up at Piedmont had a computer there in his office and had a screensaver, and scrolling across that screensaver was the message with his children's names to bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. Things like that stayed with me. He kept that in the forefront, you know, of his mind. And this is so important, not because I'm saying it, it's because it's true. Children aren't raised at church. They're raised in the home. That's where children are raised. I have a note in my Bible, and I think this, you remember, Garland Elkins had a book several years ago. Oh, and it just eluded my mind. Is it the Savior's Way? The Savior's Way by Garland Elkins? At any rate, this is a note from that book. Brother Elkins wrote, sometimes it is said, oh, I brought my children up in the church. He said, but did you bring them up in the home? That is where you are supposed to bring them up. He said, if you will make Christianity attractive to your children, if you will demonstrate to them that it means everything to you, they'll be able to see what it has done for you, and then they will want to be Christians. I'm afraid that's not always how we do it today. You know, because it's not the church's job. Is it great that the church provides activities? Sure it is. Anything wrong with that? Nothing wrong with that. Having said that, it's not the church's job. It's not the elder's job. It's not the youth minister's job to raise your children, to raise my children. It's your job to raise your children. You know, and not just talking about Chance, though here Chance is our college minister. It wouldn't be appropriate. Well, Chance needs to be doing, have more activities for these young. He's just not, of course, Chance does so much. No one will ever say that. I'm just giving you an example. It's not Chance's job to raise your kids, right? That's your job. It's not the church's job to be the parent. The parents are the parents. That's something we can't abdicate to anybody else. Church can't do that. The home is where kids are raised. And so from Samuel, I learned I need to have plans for my children, plans they'll serve God faithfully. Samuel. Turn to 1 Samuel 25 now, same book, 25th chapter. Meet a wealthy man named Nabal, whose wife was Abigail. In some ways, I'm afraid I relate to Nabal. I hope not too many ways. But in some ways, I fear I do. We're told that his wife Abigail was discerning and beautiful, but her husband was harsh, badly behaved. Well, he had a lot of animals. He was a wealthy man. When David heard that Nabal was shearing his sheep, he sent some of his men, I think 10 young men, it says, he sent to Nabal. And David told them this, go greet Nabal in my name. And he said, and tell Nabal that as long as his shepherds have been with us, we protected them. You haven't lost anything. My men looked out for your men, and we kept all your stuff safe. And so they were then to ask Nabal for some food since it was a feast day. But look what Nabal said. Who is David? Reminds me a little bit of Pharaoh It's not usually good to ask in the Bible, who is somebody? Who is Jehovah that I should obey his voice? Well, he found out, and Abel's going to find out too. Who is David? And notice what he said next. Listen to this guy. There are many servants these days breaking away from their masters. What does that mean? For all I know, this David's just a runaway slave. You're telling me he's some important person that I need, I ought to help him out, show my appreciation. For all I know, he's a runaway slave, and you're coming to get some grub. He said, shall I take my bread and my water and my meat and give it to somebody that comes from I don't know where? That's what he said. Am I going to do that? I don't think so. When David's men came back and told him what Nabal had said, he wasn't pleased. That's an understatement. You know, he said, strap on your swords, men. David took 400 men with him. This was not going to end well for Nabal. Word got back to Abigail, Nabal's wife. See why she was called discerning. Word got back to Abigail about what had happened and what David intended to do. So notice what she does. She doesn't tell her husband. She knows what he would have thought. She took 200 loaves, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep that were already prepared. She took grain. She took 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs. She took a lot of provisions. She loaded them up, had her servants load them up on donkeys. She said to her men, y'all go on ahead of me. I will follow behind. When she saw David, she got off of the donkey, fell down before him. Look at chapter 25, verse 24. I went too far. On me alone, she said, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears, David. Listen to what I have to say. Let not, verse 25, let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow, Nabal. For as his name is, that's what I wanted to look at. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But she said, I didn't know about what had happened. I didn't know you'd sent men to him and what he had said. I, your servant, did not see the young men that you sent. Now, the English Standard Version, and maybe other versions do as well, but the ESV here has a footnote. She said, Nabal, as his name is, so is he. What does Nabal mean? Does anybody have that same footnote? Fool. Nabal means fool. She said, as his name is, so is he. Now, why would his parents have named him that? And, you know, think about it. If they ever needed him to bring it, they would have said, come here, fool. And they're just calling his name. Get over here, fool. Yes, Mom. Why did they name him that? I guess Nabal's parents, though, got what they wanted. They named him fool, and he lived down to their expectations. You know, excuse me, no right-thinking person today, no right-thinking person is going to name their child fool. But how many people today raise their children to be just that? They would never name them fool. You know, come here, stupid. Wouldn't do that. But they raised them that way. Look at Proverbs 17:25, what Solomon says. Solomon had a lot to say, and his sons didn't always listen to him, did they? Sometimes I'm afraid they followed maybe his example more than they did his words. Solomon said, a foolish son is a grief to his father and bitterness to the woman who bore him. Proverbs 17:25. We had this thing this past week at Jacksonville High School. JSU put it on. It was a robotics camp. If you get the Aniston Star, that was my team on the front page. Mercifully, I was cropped out. I would have been right to the left of the guy in the white shirt. We spent all week there at robot camp. Made the finals. But you see, sometimes parents will bring their children. And you can tell after, it don't take too awful long to tell what parents are going to make their kids behave and which ones won't. Do you know what I mean? You can be around parents for a little while and you know, you see it at church. You know, you've seen that before. I remember I've told this story before, but I remember one of my cousins would sit behind us there and she would tell the boy, and she would whisper, but she had the whisper that really was, might as well just talk. You whisper so loud, "If you don't be quiet, I'm going to take you out." And, you know, it's like, you might as well just say it, because, well, I mean, that's a loud whisper. And then the first time, you know, finally you're like, all right, because the first time you ever hear that, you're like, all right, little one, you fixing to get it. You better be quiet. She's fixing to take you out. Yes! And then you hear it again. If you don't be quiet, I'll spank you. And then you start, you're like, okay, well, let's go ahead and do it. About the eighth time, you're like, I'm going to do it if you don't. I'm going to take you out. And you ain't never going to take him out. You're just going to say you're going to take him out. And after a while, and there's some people that raise their whole, like you'll see generations of their family get raised like that, or they'll have multiple children, and every child gets raised like that. They don't discipline them, and they end up just being headaches for everybody because they didn't discipline their kids. And now you're, you know, one of the things that you want to say and you can't never, ever say because people look at you like you're, you know, aghast, but you want to say your bad parenting now is reflecting on all of us. Just basic stuff. Basic stuff. We went to the movies yesterday. I took the girls, went to see Minions. Have you seen that advertised? Boy, it's a classic. 2 hour and a half, and the Minions don't speak English. I'm not even sure they speak Spanish. It's like, I'm asking, you know, Brianna wanted to go see it, and I'm like, did you like it? And I asked Leah, and Leah said, but we got there, and there's this little boy just running around. Before we even got in, the lady, because I said, I need one adult and 3 kids tickets. And she looked at me kind of funny. She said, well, how old is your youngest? And I said, 5. There was a little boy beside us that had ran over, got away from his parents and ran over and was in our group. And she said, I thought that boy was with you. I said, no, ma'am. Well, I heard his daddy say, this is his first time at the movies. We can't wait to see how it goes. And I'm not making this up. This is stuff that don't happen to y'all. This doesn't happen to normal people. All right. Well, I'm about to tell you don't happen to normal people. We walked into the theater. There's 18 different movies showing, you know. What movie do you reckon they went to? Minions. And we were in there already. We're the first ones in there. I'm early. I'm going to get there an hour before the preview. Just sit in the dark because I want to get there early. All right. Well, when they came in, who do you reckon they sat right slap behind? And I heard him, because I knew, because he said, it's our first time. He said it again. It's our first time. We're going to see how it's going to go. And you know, a normal person, happy-go-lucky person would just have said, you know what? It's just a movie. I don't even care. He can be pulling my hair. He can jump up in my chair and hit me in the head with popcorn. I'm going to smile. Because that's just great. But I saw him get away from his parents, and he ran down the aisle. And then they went, get back here. He didn't get back here. You know what we did? And I know this qualifies me, you know, for just bad person. I get that. But I asked Brianna, I said, you want to move? I whispered, as right behind, I said, you want to move? No. Leah, you want to better move up some. No, we're good. What do you want to move for? Well, we moved. Okay, well, we're moving. And we went 4 rows down. And I know that guy was saying, look at them. I guess they think they're better than them. I don't want your kid jumping on my head during the movie. And I would hear during the movie, as loud as that movie was, I'd still hear in the back, la, 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 la. And I'm like, and every time I heard it though, I thought, good call, Renfro. You made the right call. Even if it was unpopular with the people around you, you made the right call. Well, that's what I'm saying here. I don't want to raise, and you know what's going to happen today. Ain't no doubt what's going to happen today. Alan's going to be preaching to us, and Jack's going to make a run for it, and he's going to be in the pulpit with Alan. Because Mama told me you ever talk about somebody, it comes right back to you. But at any rate, I want my children to grow up and respect authority, and I know the first authority they encounter is authority in the home. Authority in the home. And if they don't respect authority in the home, they're going to be kids that grow up. They're going to go to school and not respect authority. They'll be adults that grow up and don't respect authority in society, on the job. They're going to end up in jail, many of them worse. I can tell at school which kids might demand their parents and don't. You know, which kids will talk back to you and think nothing of it. Which kids, yes, sir. One, there was a coach there from Piedmont. I should know he's from Piedmont. He's going to be a rock solid person. But he brought his son, 11 years old. As soon as I said, you're going to have fun here today? You looking forward to it? Yes, sir. Everything he said was yes, sir. No, sir. Yes, sir. And you see, that doesn't happen by accident. That's his dad. You know, that's his mom raising him right. Well, you know the rest of the story here. Abigail actually went on to marry David, didn't she? When she did go back and tell her husband what happened, he had a stroke or something. Heart became as a stone within him, and a few days later he was dead, and she married David. So I guess that's a lesson for us husbands. You know, listen to your wives, you're going to kill over dead, but I don't know. But Nabal means fool. Nabal, and he lived down to his name. Last one's going to be over in 2 Samuel. You know the story of David and Bathsheba. David sees this beautiful woman, has her brought to him, commits adultery with her. She ends up with child. He has a problem. He tries to get her husband to come home to lie with her so he'll believe the child is his. He has too much honor. He says, my men are fighting. I can't do that. David says, well, I'll tell you what. I'm just going to have him killed. He sends him, Uriah was his name, sends him to the hottest part of the battle. Uriah loses his life, essentially was murdered. Well, afterwards, God sends Nathan, the prophet, to David with a parable of sorts. It's in 2 Samuel chapter 12. And Nathan said to David, there were two men in a certain city. I just see David listening to this. David, there were two men in a certain city. One of them was rich and the other one was poor. The rich man had many flocks and herds, but the poor man had only one little lamb. He said the poor man raised that lamb and treated it like a member of his family. Listen to what he said it did. It ate his own food. Any of you have pets that basically sit at the dinner table? It ate his own food, drank from his own cup, said it held it in his arms. It was like a daughter to him, is what he said. But one day a traveler came to the rich man, the one that had the many flocks and herds. And of course, according to those traditions of hospitality, it would have been expected to provide food for this man, this traveler who had stopped by. But instead of taking one of his animals, he had many animals, the rich man took the poor man's only little lamb and cooked it for his guest. It's the worst story ever. Cooked it, prepared it for his guest. When David heard that, David was furious. As Jehovah lives, he said, as the Lord is my witness, he would say, the man who has done this, he deserves to die. He deserves to die. But David said, here's the punishment that's going to be meted down. He's going to restore that lamb fourfold. I'll tell you that. He ought to die, but he's going to restore that lamb fourfold. Well, it was then that Nathan said to David, David, it's you. You are the one. You are the man. He said, God gave you all that you could ever want. You have more than your heart could desire. Why did you take Uriah's wife away from him and have him killed? He said God's message to him was, because you have done this, David, the sword is never going to depart from your house. I'm going to take your wives, God said. I'm going to give them to your neighbor. David, how about this? You did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. You can read on and see just what was meant by that and how it came to pass. But this is the point I wanted to make with Nathan. I wonder if we appreciate the courage that it took for Nathan to tell this to David. Because not everyone who took bad news to David lived to tell about it. You remember what I'm fixing to say? You know what I'm fixing to say? Do you remember when the Amalekite went to David with King Saul's crown, claiming to have killed him? He brought back Saul's crown and his armlet. And what the Amalekite said to David, David could see that, you know, here comes a man, he's in mourning. They all put on the sackcloth and ashes. They knew that something was wrong. And King Saul, we know how King Saul died. He fell on his sword. But what this man said when he got there is he said, well, King Saul, he did fall on his sword, but he was still kind of lingering, and he asked me to finish him off, so to say. And so that's what I did. It seems as though he thought that he brings back the crown, brings back Saul's, you know, his armlet, as I said, bracelet or whatever. It seems as though he thought that David would give him a reward for that, or think he was somehow brave or somehow deserved some kind of compensation for this. If that's what he thought, oh boy, was he wrong. You know, and here's the thing, in all likelihood, he was just the first person to come across Saul's dead body and he looted it. He took the stuff from it. But let's say his story is true. If his story is true, think about the irony involved. Because remember, Saul earlier had been commanded to destroy who? What people? The Amalekites. Saul had been commanded to utterly destroy the Amalekites. Of course, he didn't. And if that is true, what the man said, probably not true. But if it was, an Amalekite made it back and was the end of him. I think that's interesting. But at any rate, David, you know, like on Andy Griffith, Andy would say, oh, you ought not have done that. David was not impressed. David said, were you not afraid to lift your hand and to kill the Lord's anointed? Because remember, David had had several opportunities if he had wanted to take Saul's life, and he wouldn't. Remember, he like took the hem of his garment once to say, I could have had your life, but I'm not going to do that. I believe, as a scoundrel as you are, you know, he didn't say that. You are the Lord's anointed. I'm not going to move my hand against Jehovah's anointed. And if I, David, am not going to do that, then who in the world do you think you are to do that? And so what did David do? David had one of his men. He said, cut him down. And that messenger who thought he was going to get reward cost him his life. And so my point is just this. Nathan might have had reason for concern. I've got to go to David, and I've got to bring him some news he's not going to want to hear. I think Nathan might have had reason for concern, but when David heard Nathan's message, David said, I have sinned against Jehovah. Nathan told him that God forgave him, but he said, the child that you conceive with Bathsheba is going to die. In fact, four of David's sons would die. And isn't that interesting? Because what did David say when he said he's going to restore that lamb fourfold? Well, David lost four of his lambs. David restored fourfold. In addition to the child that died, Amnon and Absalom and Adonijah, four of David's sons there, died. Now, we're getting to the nitty gritty. David went on to have other children with Bathsheba, Solomon being the first. But I want you to notice this is in 1 Chronicles 3:5. These were born to him, and him here is David, in Jerusalem. Shemaiah, Shobab, Nathan, and Solomon, four by Bathsheba, that's just a variant form of Bathsheba, the daughter of Amiel. Now these, again, are not listed chronologically in birth order because we know that Solomon was the first child of David and Bathsheba to survive, right? And he's listed fourth on this list. But our attention is drawn to the third name on that list. Nathan. Which means he gave. This child obviously would have been born after Nathan came to David with his parable. And so this is what's interesting to me. It's not so much the meaning of Nathan's name, but the fact that David named a child after the man who gave him one of the severest rebukes that he ever received in his life. What do you think about that? Named his son Nathan. And Nathan wasn't one that went and told David about sunshine and rainbows. He said, David, I'm going to tell you what, you've sinned. You're the one I'm talking about. You're the one who deserves to die. You deserve to die by your own mouth, and you're going to restore fourfold, and the sword is never going to leave your house. And what did David say? That's off with your head. David said, I have sinned. You are right. and he named his son after Nathan. What about that? Boy, that says a lot, I think. How do we handle rebuke? How do we handle correction? I don't know about who likes to be corrected, right? Usually, human nature is, we get mad at whoever did it. Even if they're right, we probably our first response is to get angry. Well, they didn't have to do that. Or we'll say, this is a classic one. It's not what you said, it's how you said it. Well, that may be, and sometimes that may just be a cop-out. Sometimes it doesn't matter how you said it, they ain't going to like it. That's just what we say to make ourselves maybe feel better about it. Well, I just don't like how they said it. Was there a better way Nathan could have said what he said? Right. I just don't like how he said it. Proverbs 17:10. This is a verse to remember. A rebuke goes deeper into a man of understanding than 100 stripes, 100 blows into a fool. You know, that's the saying, a word to the wise is sufficient. You could beat a fool 100 times, doesn't make him any wiser. But you take a man that is wise, that has understanding, and you give him correction, and he'll take it to heart. And that's what David did. He took correction to heart. Boy, that's hard for us today, isn't it? I wonder if we appreciate those who teach us, even if they have to correct us some along the way. I'm thankful. And I'm not beyond correction now, but I'm thankful growing up. I think a lot of preachers today, and especially young ones, that all they ever hear is praise. They hear someone in their ear whispering praise, telling them how great they are. They're the greatest thing ever. They're just the best this and the best that. And, you know, we need to encourage our young people, but we need to kind of, we need not to be flatterers, or we don't want to go. We need to be realistic, you know. Encouragement is good. But I'm also glad that growing up I had a mentor or two that could that encouraged me. They didn't just put me down. They encouraged me, but I knew that they loved me, and out of that base of care, they could tell me, now, Brandon, you didn't do right here. And I've had that told me before, and they were right. They'd say, we could talk as Christians talk to each other, and to say, well, I don't agree with that. Or I don't think I would have, you know, I wouldn't have said that, or I don't. And I'm thankful for that. I don't want somebody to, everything you do is right because you do it. You know, I'm going to go on your Facebook page and say, amen. Not everything everybody does is right. Everything everybody does deserves to be commended. Sometimes we deserve and need correction. Now, how do we respond when we get it? I think it takes courage to say something when you are reasonably certain the other person won't like it. You know, when preachers do that from the pulpit, more than a few have lost their jobs. Some have lost their heads. I think about John the Baptist when he told you, it's not lawful for you to have your brother Philip's wife. But preachers can lose their jobs for that when they make the wrong person angry. Isn't that something? You know, they talk about retirement. People have retirement, or a teacher can be tenured, you know. But preachers in the main are at the mercy of, you know, you don't think it's ever happened before that a preacher makes some influential church member angry? You know, a person that has more influence than they deserve. And if I can just be honest, in many cases, they've got more money than they've got morals. They've got more collateral than they got character. But they made some wrong person mad. And then they run them out of town. And all their great sin was they taught the truth. You don't think that happens? You don't think that has happened before? Paul said, am I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? Right? How do we respond when we receive correction? I think that we need to love those. And that's not an excuse for preachers to have mean-spirited or how they go about, you know, sweetness of speech. Proverbs says that sweetness of speech increases persuasiveness. And that is certainly true. But we need to love those who teach us the truth, even if what they say stings us some. From time to time, I'm talking about myself. When I hear teaching from Alan, when I hear teaching from Chance or from others, you know, I think I hear things and I think I need to work on that. I'm not going to get mad at Alan for correcting me. If I have a right heart, I'm going to appreciate it. I'm going to evaluate what he says and say, does he have a point there? You know what? What he said is true, and I need to fix that. If my heart is right, that's what I'll do. Now, we have 2 minutes. What do we have, Robert? Am I done?
Look at that, 5 minutes. I thought I wasn't going to have time to finish this lesson. I really did going in. I want to look at one more passage. Well, maybe two. No more than two. No more than ten. Passage in the book of Revelation, chapter 2. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who conquers, I will give some of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone with a new name written on the stone that no one knows except the one who receives it. Similar passage in Revelation chapter 3. In fact, this occurs a few times in this book. God says, I'm going to give you a new name. Now, in context, the new name seems to be an allusion to the name of Christ, suggesting the idea of being fellowship in His presence. But I think the thought here that it presents is still interesting, even if I wouldn't press it and certainly wouldn't be dogmatic about it. What if God, when we enter heaven, gives us a new name that reflects the qualities that we developed while we were on the earth? Or what if God right now were to give us a name in keeping with our true character? What would your name be? And what would it mean? You know, Luke wrote his two books to a man named Theophilus, Acts 1 verse 1. Theophilus means Theos is God, Philos, friend of God. Sometimes see it translated lover of God. Would your name suggest, if God gave you a name, one who loves Him and who loves His Son? I think about the apostles. They once named a man named Joseph, gave him the additional name Barnabas, which means son of exhortation. We would say one who encourages. Barnabas was really good at encouraging other people. The apostles saw that. They named him that. Wouldn't that be a wonderful name for God to give you one day? Encourager. On the other hand, you remember when Rachel was giving birth to Benjamin, was having a hard labor. In fact, she died. And she wanted to name that boy Ben-Noni. Ben-Noni, which means, if you have the NIV footnote says, son of my trouble. The ESV says, son of my sorrow. Aren't you glad that his father stepped in and said, we're going to name him Benjamin. Benjamin, son of my strength. Son of my right hand. Can you imagine that boy growing up later, knowing, you know, finds out his mother died during birth. Really, my name means son of my sorrow. I'm glad for that boy that his father changed the name. But would God's name for us indicate that we were a son or daughter of trouble? A son or daughter that caused him sorrow? I wonder if God gave us the name, if it would be one who complains. I'd hate for that. One who criticizes. You know, there, as much as I wish it were otherwise, there are church members out there that seem to thrive on criticizing others or criticizing works of the church. They thrive on it. That would not be the name that I would want God to give me. Proverbs 22 verse 1 says, A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches. If God gives you a name one day, what will it say about you? Because you are earning that name right now. Right now. Thank you very much for your attention today, for being in class. Truly appreciate it. Thank you.